Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City, friends. Yes, here at NOLA Drinks, friends. We don't pour all the booze into our glass, hoping that some of it spills out into your glass just so you get some, because everybody knows that trickle-down pouring doesn't work. Yep, we got a good show here for you coming up today. Friends, happy to be here. We are in the full tilt of the holiday season. We are absolutely in full swing here in New Orleans for the holiday season. And that's we're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later on in the show. I'll have a couple guests actually tape this a couple days ago over at Two Jags, the famed restaurant, second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, opened up in 1856. And I was joined by recent guests who were on with me not too long ago. I think we're going to make this a regular thing. Paul Gustings, who runs the beverage program and the bar there at Two Jags, as well as Chris Hanna, who runs the bar at French 75, the French 75 bar, of course, there at Arno's restaurant, both spots there in the French Quarter. And these guys are just walking encyclopedias of knowledge as it relates to drinks and cocktails, and they're into the history of these things and understand these things, know so many people, know so many things. So it's an interesting conversation. Now, when we had them on last time, ostensibly, we were going to talk about fall drinks, friends, and we really didn't get there. We kind of talked about their differing approaches to the Sazerac. That's a year-round drink, as far as I'm concerned, okay? So we didn't really get there on the fall drinks. This time, sort of, the plan was to talk about winter drinks, and we were a little more successful in this run. We talk about the interesting history and idea of the grasshopper, which was, of course, invented at Two Jags. We talk about hot buttered rum. We talk about an English milk punch that Paul is making. We talk a little bit about gin versus cognac, post-World War II cocktails. And a lot of this is tied into the history of Arno's and Two Jags. It's a really interesting conversation with these guys. So we got that coming up. That's going to be pretty fun. We're also in a little bit here, going to talk about understanding the cost of a bottle of wine. And this is something that I have a pretty good background in. And we're going to look at a couple different cost models. And I just kind of want to share with you what goes into making a bottle of wine from a cost perspective and maybe some implications for what that means for the price tag on the shelf or the price tag on a wine list. We'll touch on that. And, you know, a few other things like we like to do here on the NOLA Drinks Show. Of course, what's going on this month? And friends, right now, there's so much going on. And, you know, I usually like to run down events in town. Check out our good buddy Frank Stansberry, who runs the La Fete newsletter. He gives a great rundown. NOLA.com has a great calendar. So, you know, we're going to kind of leave it like that. I'm not going to run down everything that's going on because that would be the next hour of the show and we got other things to get to. But one thing that I did want to highlight is the Revillon dinners. And if you're not familiar, it's a great opportunity, much like Culinary Month was in August or Restaurant Week was in September, to get out there and try maybe a classic spot that you haven't been to in years, try something new if they're participating that you haven't been to. But what the Revillon dinners are now these days, and we'll get into this in a second, what they were before, it's a great opportunity. They're price-fixed menus, usually about four courses, give or take. Unlike, you know, in most of the cases, say, with Culinary Month in August or Restaurant Week in September, those were kind of designed, in my view, to be a little bit more like good deals, right? Where you're going to go get a 3-4-course meal, maybe a drink thrown in as a little bit of lagniappe or a dessert, extra course, something like that, as lagniappe thrown in for a really, really good price. As a matter of fact, they're, you know, capped generally at, I think, what was it, $39 for dinner, if I remember right, and $20 for lunch. So that's kind of the whole idea. And then people try and compete, and I think some restaurants do anyway. You know, how much goodness can they give you for, say, $39 for dinner? In the case of the Revillon dinners, it's a little bit different. A lot of people are treating it that way, so you're seeing some like great four-course meals for south of $50. You know, I'll give a couple examples. Antoine's doing four courses, Two Jags that we just talked about, four courses for $54. Galatoire's has four courses. The range there is $40 to $59. Arno's is $49. So, there's some good deals there. And then sort of topping out at the top end there would be, say, Commander's Palace. Now, they're doing a 7-course meal that I think does include a drink, and that's about $100 a head. So some of these are really extravagant meals, and some of these are a little bit more, you know, straightforward. But it's also kind of competitive. People try and put these great menus together, and it's a great opportunity to go out. It's really kind of going on the whole month. It's going to end here at the end of the month pretty much everywhere as far as I know. But Great chance during the holiday week to go out and try some of these great restaurants for a reasonable price. Lots of times the stuff that's on the menu is not on their regular menu. You've got chefs trying to outdo themselves. It's really a lot of fun. Now, you may ask, if you're from around here, you may know or know of the Revillon Dinners. But if you're from here and don't know, or you're listening elsewhere and don't know, Revillon, it's a French word, and it basically translates to the term awakening, and it's rooted in religious tradition, and it's really French Creole tradition. And the idea was that, you know, the French Creoles, who obviously dominated the early settlement of New Orleans, would do these dinners so people would fast through Christmas Eve and then come home from a Christmas Mass that evening and then engage in a overnight meal, basically. And these were long, as we like to do in New Orleans still, these long meals where you sit there and chicken and oyster gumbo pies, things like that, game, eggs, turtle soup, lots of drinks, souffles, grits and griot, candied fruits, things like that, definitely, as I mentioned, some drinking. And the dinners generally lasted until dawn. And this was part of the tradition. Now, basically, when and a lot of this is coming, a great read to check out, by the way, Liz Williams, who is the director of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, has a book called New Orleans, A Food Biography. And this is where a lot of this information is coming from. That's a great museum, by the way, to go check that out if you haven't. And the Revillon dinners basically disappeared, according to her, as quote-unquote American Christmas traditions usurped the Creole-French tradition. And so they more or less disappeared. Now, some of the reality of this, too, is that, you know, hey, if you're going to Mass and then you're coming home expecting to have this multi-course dinner that lasts hours until dawn, somebody's got to be there cooking it. Of course, what that means is typically these were servants or slaves that were making these meals overnight for people who could afford to have them and host them. And so, you know, that has a lot to do, of course, why they're no longer around. In the 1990s, then, so they, you know, by the early 20th century, this is an 1800s tradition. By the 20th century, you know, we're pretty much looking at this stuff being, as I mentioned, usurped. I'll use the word that Liz uses with American traditions and stuff. And so they resurfaced in the 1990s, and, you know, more or less as a marketing gimmick here to get people out during the December months to go try some of the restaurants. Works for me. And now, obviously, these are kind of these happen during normal dinner hours and normal business hours. But it's really cool. They are meant to be a little bit longer meals in most cases. So the idea of the restaurant, if they're doing it right, in my view, they're not trying to rush you through the courses and get you out. You know, you're going to sit there, you're going to take some time, you're going to enjoy a multi-course meal and do all that. So, hey, you know, things change, things need to change. Yes, it is a bit of a marketing gimmick, but it's still really cool, and it harkens to a French Creole tradition, as I mentioned, here in New Orleans that goes back to the 1800s, and, you know, we like to do stuff like that here in New Orleans, so maybe it's not the same as it used to be. Hey, if you want to cook yourself a great meal and eat overnight on Christmas Eve, I am all for it, so you do it. I just can't stay up that late, so that's not going to happen. But get out there and check out some of the restaurants. I mentioned some of the classic restaurants, Two Jags, Antoine's, Galatoire's, Arno's, doing that stuff. Broussard's is participating. Some new folks, the Country Club, there in the Bywater, which I had the great pleasure of eating at not too long ago for the first time. Dinner, man, that was fantastic. Let's see, Fountain Lounge in the Roosevelt Hotel, Gumbo Shop. A lot of these guys are in the quarter, of course, are in the CBD. I mentioned Commander's Palace, Caribbean Room, Seaworthy, Cafe Degas there in Mid-City, Muriel's, Pelican Club, Sobu. Sobu's got, they're throwing in a drink. A lot of folks are throwing in a drink. And there's also something else going on, too, called Revillon on the Rocks. This is a new part of the program because we like drinks here on NOLA Drinks. You know that. And, yeah, so the Revillon on the Rocks thing is there are about 20 bars that are participating, and they're all doing a special cocktail that's obviously winter, so a lot of creamy goodness, a glug-glug drink, as my wife likes to call it, because they go down really fast. Got to be careful. A lot of them have booze, a lot of booze in them. But so sort of a neat program. So you have some places that you might expect, say, the Bombay Club, folks like that, Sobu, I believe, as I mentioned. But even like the Aaron Rose, you know, which is a famous, I don't want to call it a dive bar because it's way better than that, but it's like a, you know, an upscale. Nah, it's not fair either. It's a dive bar, but it's a dive bar with some groove, okay? And the Aaron Rose, they're doing their famous frozen Irish coffee, which is a New Orleans staple, by the way. Go check that out there in the quarter there. And yeah, they're participating as well. So if you want to check out all the menus and you want to check out, you know, all the cocktails, who's participating in that, the website to go to is called followyourjoy.com. Again, followyourjoy.com. And they'll get you all hooked up with everything you want to know. Get out there and try a Revillon dinner. Go see some of our places. We'll see you around town. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about the cost of a bottle of wine. Come on back.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. We're here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, or in podcast land, wherever you may be. However you're listening to the show, I greatly appreciate it. Yeah, friends, if you can't tell by my voice, getting over a little bit of a cold. If when you listen to the interview a little bit later on the show with Chris Hanna and Paul Gustings, you will hear I get progressively more congested as the interview goes on. Feeling better. Not that we're all worried about that, getting over it, but pardon my voice here a little bit, or if I cough or scratch and that sort of thing. Maybe I go a little Peter Brady and my voice breaks. So there you go. I wanted to talk a little bit about breaking down the cost of a bottle of wine and understanding why wines cost what they cost. Now, some of my motivation for doing this today, recently I taught a class to a group of wine education class, which I do a lot of, to a group of bartenders that were connected with the United States Bartenders Guild New Orleans chapter. And they asked me to come in and do sort of a basic wine class. And obviously, a lot of these folks had a pretty good deal of knowledge as it relates to wine, the production method to a degree, you know, viticulture, how things are made, that sort of thing. And some, you know, more than others. And I kind of keep this class loose and fast, I guess you can say, fast and loose. And why I do that is I never really know how much people know. So sometimes maybe I'm doing this for a tasting room staff, or I'm doing this for a restaurant staff with some knowledge. Maybe I often do it for members of the public who maybe have, some have lots of knowledge, some don't, you know, everything in between. And I really never know what I'm going to end up with. And what I noticed in this particular presentation, that a lot of the interest sort of universally across the group here was an interest in understanding some of the economics behind wines. And that is, again, where I have a pretty good deal of background coming from the California wine industry, as I do. And so that's what I, you know, I just wanted to share that with you, some of these things that I've talked about in the class for years. A lot of people think, you know, and there's that joke, how do you make a, you know, a small fortune in the wine business? Start with a larger fortune. It's a tough business, and it really is an economy of scale. So if you're making a half a million cases a year, you know, if you're just making 50 cents or a dollar on a bottle, you're doing okay, probably. But if you're a small winery, and we're going to kind of go with a, you know, say a 3,000 to 5,000 cases a year production level here. And that, believe me, it may sound big or small to you, but that's small. And that's pretty typical of what we might call a boutique winery. And we're going to kind of stick to a domestic model here with some other implications as far as competition goes. But, you know, kind of a maybe a typical, prototypical California boutique winery. Now, I'm going to come back to this model, but I'm going to run down some quick numbers here for you. So if we want to look at just some of the basic costs of making a bottle of wine, we're going to look at the cost of the cork. And this, I'm just going to go with this one model. And there's a lot of variation here, and I'll explain some of this stuff, but just to keep our argument kind of simple and give you a framework. So if we said cost of a natural cork is about $1.50 a pop, that's pretty correct. Probably throw in the cost of the wine foil or the capsule is going to be included in that. The cost of a decent glass bottle is about $1.50. a lot of variation there. Cost of a label, just printing a label, is about 50 cents. Wine production itself, when you consider the grapes and staff and some of that stuff, is about $5 per bottle. And if you mark that up a buck, what you end up with is $9.50, and that's what you're selling it to, making just a dollar a bottle. The cost to sell it, say, to a distributor, like we have to do here in Louisiana, you have to sell through a distributor, the so-called second tier. We have a three-tiered system. So the distributor's getting it for $9.50. Then here's their markup, which is a pretty typical number in this model that I'm using. This comes from Vine Pair, by the way, just so you know. The cost to the retailer then from the distributor is $17. Now, I tend to see markups being a little bit less maybe than that, not, you know, it's usually about 25 to 30%. It's pretty much the norm. This is obviously pushing what they're using here, closer to 50%, but we'll go with that. So from $9.50 to the distributor, selling it to the retailer for $17, then the typical markup to the consumer then is going to be about $28 to $30 a bottle. So we've gone from the winery selling it for $9.50, producing it for $8.50, and then it's, you know, ending up at a bottle shop for you at $28 to $30. Okay, now here in Louisiana, one of the things too is that, you know, as I said, you have to sell it through a distributor, so you got a middleman. They take their cut. Some distributors are good, some are not so good. A lot of variation in between. You know, making their a necessary evil because it's legislated here. That's a story for another time. But you know, they're the ones who bring the wine to the restaurants. They're the ones who bring the wine to the bottle shops, so they get their cut. Obviously, the retailer gets it. Now in Louisiana, you have to the minimum markup is 6%. So you're always going to have a 6% markup, and that's to kind of prevent people from undercutting and maybe selling things at a loss as a loss leader or something like that to get you into the store. And then, you know, there's the markup, obviously, to the wine shop. So as you can see, or excuse me, to the consumer from the wine shop, as you can see, there's not a lot of room. The distributor's doing pretty well for really just hawking the wines. But the retailer, when you consider going up, you know, 17, then marking that up, say, to 28, $10 a bottle, and you consider that maybe space cost of overhead, staffing, things like, nobody's getting rich in this game, okay? And let's just look at that math. If I made 5,000 cases a year, and we're sticking with this model, we're going to get to a premium model in the next segment. But if I do that, 5,000 cases, 60,000 bottles, that's only $60,000 if I'm making a dollar a bottle, right? $60,000 profit, and you're running a business, that's pretty tough. That's, you're not getting rich, right? I mean, that's not, you're not making $500,000. Now, I mentioned a little bit too about, you know, certain considerations of the cost. So the cork, yes, you can use artificial corks, which are a little bit less. The Stelvin enclosures, the screw tops, those prices can differ a little bit. I mentioned the cost. So we used $1.50 here, cost of the wine foil or the capsule. Now, a premium capsule is going to cost you, set you back, and those are the ones made of metal, right? The nice wine foil. That's going to set you back probably about 30 to 40 cents a pop. And then you get down to those the cheap plastic ones that we know on certain wines that'll get down to just a few cents for those. So you can see 30 cents difference or something like that. That really matters when you're looking at a bottle and you're trying to, you know, buy something for a reasonable price. Cost of glass. I used $1.50 from this model. The heavier the glass, the more expensive. Sometimes the shape of the bottle can change the price. If you're buying Chinese glass, which is typically thinner, lesser quality, that's cheaper. So there's a lot of variation there too. $1.50 is a pretty good number. It can go up and it can go down 50 cents or so, give or take. The label, we used 50 cents, but that's just the printing of the label. We're not talking about the artwork, the R&D to develop a good label, some of the marketing consideration and the intellectual property involved in a label. Wine production, $5. Now, this can vary tremendously, and this is something we could go on and on for hours, but this, you know, relates to the cost of the ton of grapes, and I'll get into that in the premium model a little bit. But $5, that's pretty low because you're talking about staffing, okay? You're talking about the cost of the grapes, the electricity, some of the, you know, materials that you have to use in making wine, oak barrels. French oak barrels are well over $1,000 these days, and American oak barrels are about, you know, $900, I believe, this year, give or take. Those are really expensive. So $5 seems to be pretty low. You also have a product that typically sits there in your cellar for a good amount of time. And sort of like any product that's sitting in a warehouse, you're losing money on it. I don't want to say it's depreciating because that doesn't really necessarily happen with wine per se, but you know, you're not selling it. It's not moving. You might have electricity costs because of air conditioning and things, refrigeration to keep the wines cold, and you're paying somebody to manage your cellar, all that kind of stuff, inventory, manage your inventory, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, it's a costly endeavor and it's a time consuming endeavor. Now we jump, of course, to the distributor, and the distributor, as I mentioned, they're going to have their markup. What a lot of distributors do, and if you throw an importer in there, we're talking about domestic stuff, but again, an importer, you're going to have two middlemen in Louisiana. You have an importer getting their cut, and then you have a distributor getting their cut. So anything coming from overseas is going to be, you know, that much more when somebody's taking another piece of the pie from out there. But, you know, most of the time a distributor around here, very typically, they charge a 3% shipping charge back to the winery. So they're charging the winery to ship the wine, say in this case that we're using hypothetically from California to here, a 3% shipping charge. The distributor also charges for buybacks. You know, wines have to be taken back. They charge the winery typically for samples that get poured. So that's not, sometimes the distributor eats that cost, but most of the time the winery is eating the cost when you go to a wine tasting of those wines being poured. So that's the second tier and kind of what's involved there. Let's do this, friends. We're going to take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come right back to this topic here. We're going to take our bottom of the hour break. Come on back.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
All All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be, however you are listening here to us at NOLA Drinks. Happy holidays to you, for one. And also, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a great end of your 2017. We got one more show before the new year, and if Christmas is your thing, Merry Christmas to you as well. We were talking a little bit about the cost of a bottle of wine, and we're using this particular model that I mentioned, where it goes, if the winery is going to make a buck in profit, it goes to the distributor for $9.50. And, you know, a lot of estimates are about $7 to make a bottle of wine without profit. There are some studies actually out there, friends, that I'm familiar with that say for a small winery like we're talking about here, we're kind of using a hypothetical 3,000 to 5,000 case per year winery as an example, that, you know, producing a bottle of wine for less than $11 or $12 when all these things that we're talking about are thrown in, it's pretty hard to do it for less than that. So you think about, wow, what does that mean? Okay. So there you go. But we talked a little bit about the distributor. Okay, they charge 3% shipping charge. They charge the winery, for the most part, the cost to pour at tastings, the buybacks, the samples, et cetera. You know, and they got to pay staff, and they're burning gas and driving around and delivering the wines and all that stuff. And again, the value of the distributor is a topic for another time. But there's their cut. But we also have to talk about, as I mentioned, things like marketing and these sorts of costs. Now, there's, you know, a lot more goes into making a bottle of wine than just simply the flat cost. We're keeping it really simple here to use that model. But let's look at a different model. Let's look at a premium model. And there's some good examples of that going on out here. Give me one second. This is from an online publication called Quora. And here's a good model of somebody assuming about 3,000 cases produced, so 36,000 bottles. And they broke it down pretty finely. So using the cost of grapes, about $7 a bottle, they're basing this on top shelf Napa Valley Cabernet. Now, I think the average cost of Cabernet, and I could be wrong about this year, was somewhere around $8,000 or $9,000 a ton in Napa. But the high range, this is in the 2016 stuff, those reports are out. The high range, there was stuff, actually a few tons that went for over $40,000. So it can vary. So there you go. Just keep that math in mind. There's huge scales of difference here in what a ton of grapes may cost. But so let's assume $7 for a top shelf Napa Valley Cabernet sounds pretty reasonable. If you're using new French oak for a significant portion of your project there, making wine, a new French oak barrel per bottle, you're looking at about $267 a bottle when you break down that cost. And I talked about that before. $1.50 for the bottle, as I talked about, 60 cents for a nice label. Okay, again, that's pretty much just printing cork. They're going 50 cents here for a high quality cork, and then 40 cents for a high quality foil. That previous model that I used said cork $1.50. As I said, that's obviously including the cost of a decent foil. Bottling breaks down to about 21 cents for a standard bottling line cost. Now, equipment's not cheap in a winery either, or if you're outsourcing, a lot of folks outsource their bottling and you have to pay somebody to do that, but we're going to go with a 21 cent number here. And then overhead, $6.82. So that's the building and new production equipment, probably based on a standard, I'm guessing maybe something like 10% of buying 10% new equipment every year. Utilities, $1.11. Employees, that's the winemaker and an assistant, so just two people, $6.67 per bottle, which, you know, you can obviously have a lot more people going on in a more significant bottling. And then marketing, they threw in a 77 cents. So back cover of a major wine magazine is where they got this, but 77 cents a bottle. Okay. That total cost there is $28.25. Now, then we're talking about a premium model where we're now talking about a luxury good that you can afford to go out and spend. And this is not, you know, a commodity. And that's probably a conversation for another time, as well as what I would call commodity wines versus premium wines. And the value that you perceive of the wine when you're paying for a label or paying for a region is not necessarily the super tight margin like we were talking about from the typical boutique wine model that I just talked about. So what we're going to do here is we're going to go from $28.25 total cost to a profit of $20. So a big markup, but you know, there you go. So that's where we start talking about, you know, our expensive bottles of Napa Cab that we might be familiar with. The wholesale markup then is going to be about $25 on that bottle. And the retail markup from there is going to be close to that. $24.75 is the estimate that they used. So all of a sudden we're looking at $100 for that bottle. So that's where you start to get that kind of price. Now, look, there's a lot of margin in there for some of these people. And let's throw this in too. A restaurant markup is going to be $150 over wholesale. So, and we'll talk about that in a second, but $225 for a restaurant price for that bottle if you go in and do that. So we can see these sort of two models where we're ending up with a $100 bottle on the shelf or we're ending up with about a $28 to $30 bottle on the shelf. And I think we know kind of what that represents. Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up, and, you know, again, lots of variation there, let me remind you of that. But those are two, I think, pretty reasonably accurate models to paint a picture for you what all this costs. Now, why I wanted to bring this up, aside from just telling you all these things, is that, you know, a lot of the emphasis in wine shops, and especially here in New Orleans, and this is pretty common everywhere in the States, and I'm going to guess elsewhere, an emphasis on trying to, you know, say our whole model is, you know, 90% of what we have is $20 or less per bottle. Now, you can find a lot of good wines out there for $20 or less a bottle. But what that's going to mean is that's often going to mean bringing in, you know, say wines that are production wines from Spain, where you can get some, you know, cheaper stuff, certainly stuff from South America, to a certain extent Australia. So a lot more foreign stuff, especially South America, is able to produce a cheaper bottle than we are here in the States. Obviously, we understand that. So that whole emphasis can be really tough, and it really puts a squeeze. If we even go back to that model where we're looking at that first model that I gave you of the $28 to $30 bottle when it ends up on the shelf retail, and we're obviously a little higher than $20, that model didn't have a whole lot of margin in it now, did it? Especially for the winery. And so trying to get, these are what these wineries sometimes are trying to compete with. A 5,000 case a year winery often does have an interest in selling in out-of-state markets and this sort of stuff. And so you want to be in wine shops, and they're competing with wines with this whole model of trying to, you know, sell a good bottle for $20 or less. Now, I'm not knocking that model. I just want to bring this to your attention because that's really hard. It's hard for a winery to make money. It's hard for a winery, a domestic winery, as we're using in this case, at that level to compete. Now, when we start talking about that premium model with a 20% profit, a $20, excuse me, profit for the premium model markup for the winery, and then the wholesale markup for the distributor being 25, and then the retail markup being more or less 25, okay, everybody's fat and happy. You know, that's what we're talking about, our bottles of silver oak or Camus or whatever. And, you know, that's a perceived value that people are willing to pay. And people are making money on that. But when we're all going out to these stores and we're trying, or going out to a restaurant, we're trying to find, you know, that sort of joke, a good bottle of Pinot under $20, it's really nearly impossible, especially with Pinot because the cost of grapes are so high. And, you know, we've talked about that before on the show. Different grapes are easier to grow and so on and so forth and are more in demand and blah, blah, blah. But Pinot's, you know, expensive per ton. So your cost of production goes up, obviously. So it's tough. So just sort of think about that, I guess, a little bit. And, you know, when you go out to a restaurant, the old school model was 3x markup, where you would take that, the wholesale price and then multiply it times 3. And that was sort of standard. You've seen a lot more people roll it back to 2x or even, you know, 1.5x. That can be tough on a restaurant. Why is that tough on a restaurant? Because lots of times what you're paying for food, they're not making a whole lot of money on food. One of the cost centers of most restaurants where they actually can make money is in the beverage program, and especially in the alcohol program. So that's where that sort of 3x markup comes from, was to ensure making some money. Some of it was also the idea is if you do that 3x markup, that this whole mentality is you get 4 glasses per bottle. You know, if you're doing, say, a buy the glass program. So if I basically pour 1 glass of wine, I've covered my cost. When you put it on a wine list, say for $12 a glass or something like that, that's kind of that math there. And you cover that, you make that up. Now, I'm not a big fan of that model because I think it's kind of lazy, but that's a conversation for another time as well. But that's where that comes from. So people backing that down back to, say, 2x or 1.5x, they're still making some money off the juice that you're drinking in your glass, but they're not making nearly as much. And if they're not making anything or very, very little off the food, that cost center, that's a big one, that alcohol one. So all of a sudden you may be dropping for a couple, you buy a bottle of wine at a restaurant and then, you know, a couple appetizers and a couple entrees, and maybe your bill's $150. You go, man, I just dropped $150 on dinner for 2 people with a bottle of wine and a nice meal. What a restaurant's making there maybe isn't as much as you might think either. And that's, we've had that conversation before on this show. We're talking about the wine business here, but I wanted to bring all this to your attention because I think there continues to be this push to make stuff, your buy stuff cheaper, the $20 or less retail bottle and all of that. And it's really hard. It's hard for wineries to be able to compete at that level. So, you know, if you're looking for a good bottle of wine, maybe sometimes spend a little bit more because you're probably going to get a little bit more. And especially if you're buying domestic, you're probably going to get a little bit more. I hope you found this somewhat educational. I hope it made some sense to you. We'll, of course, come back to these topics as we always do. But I wanted to bring that to your attention here at the holiday season when we're out buying lots of wines and sharing the joy and popping corks and doing all that good stuff like we do. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show, and then we're going to be back with Chris Hanna of French 75 and Paul Gustings of 2 Jags. Come on back. Stay here till you see our soul. It takes all that love.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
I wonder why my baby drinks so much wine. If she keeps a drinking, she's gonna lose her mind. She's a wine-head woman, don't you know? She's a wine-head woman, don't you know? I hate to do it.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Nolan Drinks Show. Brian D is here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, or in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, friends, we are here at the famed Two Jags restaurant, second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, and we are upstairs. And I'm here with my good friends, Chris Hanna and Paul Gustings. And Paul, you work here at Two Jags. Thanks for hosting, man.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for coming over.
Yeah, it's good, man. We're doing it here. Last time we did it over at Chris's place at 75. Welcome, Chris.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Absolutely. So Chris there at French 75, part of Arno's restaurant, I should mention. And again, Two Jags. Let's talk about this a little bit, you guys, Paul, before we get into... Well, we always plan this. We say we're going to talk about winter drinks and we go somewhere else. Let's just go somewhere else. Let's
can throw this whole sheaf of things away now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all those notes that I sent you.
All the notes, yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. All those bullets that I sent you we were going to talk about.
I'm glad I didn't read them.
Glad I didn't send them. It's perfect. Yeah. We're second oldest restaurant, man, in New Orleans, and we're here upstairs. Tell us a little bit about the place, man. A lot of listeners probably don't know about Two Jags.
Started in 1856. Madame Begay invented brunch. Famous through the years for hosting I don't know how many people from all over the world. Presidents, prime ministers, everything, people that don't mean anything, that are not famous at all.
Like me.
You know. It's been around for a while. It's a really great place to work.
Cool. Okay.
I love working here.
And sort of coming full circle, because you used to work here
a
number of years ago, and then now you just started back here recently.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, great. So, place where the grasshopper was invented.
We just had Robert Simonson. Got that ass backwards. Robert Simonson, most 15, his best drinks he had this year, and one of them was the grasshopper from here.
Oh, okay. That's pretty awesome. Cool.
Yeah, I thought it was great. Yeah. You know,
very cool.
Well, and that's let's talk about that drink for people who don't know. So let maybe Paul tell people a little bit about what it is, and I'd like to hear, what you have to say about it, too. But
I do mine differently, and...
I am not surprised.
Really? Most places you get a grasshopper. If you go up north, you get ice cream with it, Wisconsin.
Right.
Most places where you go, it's white cream de cocoa, green cream de menthe, and milk.
Yeah, equal parts, right?
Yes. Yep. That doesn't work. It's really sweet. It's kind of cloyingly sweet, and it's like, just not, you know. So what I do is I do 4 parts of white cream de cocoa, 2 parts of dark cream de cocoa, 2 parts of green cream de menthe, 1 part of white cream de menthe, and 1/2 part of brandy. Mm-hmm. And that's the half a drink. The other half of the drink is the heavy whipping cream.
Okay.
Not milk, not 1/2 and 1/2. It has to be heavy whipping cream.
Yeah. And then shake it, right?
And it's a much, much better product with the cream in it than it is with the milk in it, because it has this thickness and this creamy
viscosity
and this creaminess to it. Yeah.
And then you're still getting the green color that's desirable.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. But it's not that bright neon green.
Right. Like Gatorade.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little darker because it has the white cream de menthe and the dark cream de cocoa in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of mutes the colors.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. What's your take? Do you go about it similarly, Chris, when you do it?
I've never mixed the dark creme de cocoa or white creme de menthe, but adding cognac was a cool little find to add to the drink. And milk just doesn't really hold up. I mean, I guess if that's all you got, but Heavy whipping cream does make a big difference. You know, like even Maison Premier, they don't make any cream drinks without heavy whipping cream.
That makes sense.
Up in New York, New Orleans Theme Bar in New York, you know, when they make every single cream drink they make is heavy whipping cream. So I totally agree with that part.
Absolutely.
You know, and using that, I think you guys using that higher proof spirit is mandatory as well, because otherwise, like you said, Paul, it's cloyingly sweet. It almost tastes like a McDonald's milkshake, and it cuts it a little bit.
Now, an interesting sidebar to this is that the grandson of the man who invented the grasshopper told me that originally the grasshopper was brandy and green cream de menthe.
Oh, really?
And then nothing
and
else.
And no cream even, right?
Nothing.
Interesting.
Yes. I don't know if he was just messing with me, you know? but I mean, this is the grandson of the man who invented the drink. And that's what he said. And he goes, and then people, you know, change it over a matter of time to what it was now, to what it is now.
When was that drink first rolled out here, do you know, roughly?
Between 1918 and 1928.
Okay.
Roughly.
So maybe that has some...
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, roughly.
In that range.
Supposedly, it was done at a private competition in New York during Prohibition in 1928. But... I have no clue.
So the bartender here actually was participating in that competition.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and he came in second.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And I would be curious to know what won, because I'm going to guess it's probably still not even around.
No, it's not.
Right.
Done.
And could it be too that maybe cream or something like that was not used just because of the time, not necessarily
could
readily
very
available,
well be.
Wouldn't be able
yeah.
to keep.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah,
that sort of thing. Makes sense. Hmm. Well, Chris, so you're over there at French 75 at Arno's, and we didn't really talk about this too much last time, I don't think, but maybe just a touch of the history of Arno's? I guess we touched on it, but why don't you tell people about it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really cool history. The owner, Count Arnaud, was, you know, well-liked and regarded enough because as a maitre d' to have a following large enough to... You know, by that large dining room, and then the other dining room. The funny thing about you know, having a following big enough to go over there was I didn't realize that it was a bad neighborhood, and I'm like, there's no how is it a bad neighborhood? It's in the French Quarter. But when you read the writers of the Times Picayune living section, whatever it was called back then. They said it was a bold move for him to actually use the location he found because of the people didn't think that, you know, guests would want to go to a nice dinner in the area that I was in, which is really hilarious to me, mm-hmm. and obviously you too, because we know where it is right now.
Right.
And it's like
right.
It's the nicest, most patrolled exactly. neighborhood in the whole city. So that was pretty funny to read. I mean, I love that his mansion's still on Charters and Esplanade. Beautiful home that he had built for him there. You know, he's self-acclaimed count because he was just a cool cat.
Just character, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
You know, a picture of him with Bob Hope and LaGuardia hanging out in the dining room. It's my favorite picture. So I like that part of the history, you know, and that's one of the things I wanted to keep alive, you know. The owner, Archie Kasbarian, who passed away in 08, he knew the daughter, and he knew that it was a special place to restore and keep, you know, as one of the jewels of the French Quarter and the whole city of New Orleans in general. So that family took over in 78, and he passed in 08, and the son and daughter and mother are still running the restaurant.
That's cool. Was he a patron then, I'm assuming, of the restaurant?
And yeah, he ran the Royal Sonesta.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he was the general manager of the Royal Sonesta, and so obviously it's right across the street. He knew Jermaine Wells. He knew that she didn't have anybody looking after her and the restaurant for when she was, you know, getting up in age. And so he it was his, you know, dream and his whole project to redo all the rooms upstairs, so they're private dining spaces, which is what he was used to having. With all the spaces available in the Royal Sonesta, so he knew how to turn that into like a sales, like there's, you know, right now we're in an event space up here in the second story of
Two Jacks.
Yeah, so I mean the whole history is cool. Both families really are, you know, taking a joy to the place. I really like the whole story about Count Arnaud. So
that's cool. When was the place established, Chris? When was it?
Next year is going to be 100.
Great.
So we got it in 1917 and established it in 1918.
Okay. And I assume that you guys are starting to make some plans for the 100th anniversary.
Yeah, the owners have some special dinners. You know, I mean, I personally am trying to make a a kind of a fun and better, more full-bodied cocktail than the Arnaud Special cocktail.
Okay.
That Ted Haig put in this book. So now that's a whole other tangent. I probably shouldn't have went there. Probably,
about that. Probably not. You know, it was really, we got about 30 seconds till a commercial breaks here. Saved, man.
Okay, good. Yeah,
we all know Ted.
Yeah. No, I love Ted Haig and I appreciate it. But after you put that in the book, it just, people just think like, well, they'll come to the bar in search of this cocktail, and it's okay. So I've prepared for a better one to release next year.
Cool.
Yeah. So it'll still be having Arnaud's name on it. It'll be the Arnaud's Jubilee, since it'll be our Jubilee 100-year anniversary. Yeah.
Cool. Well, you guys, let's do this. Let's take a little break here on the show. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about a little bit more about the establishments of these two fine gentlemen at which they work, as well as talk about some winter beverages. We'll get that on the agenda this time, friends. Come on back.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelanco here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to over-oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc. A great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Oh, I feel like.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. We are chatting with Paul Gustings of Two Jags Restaurant and Chris Hanna of the French 75 Bar, part of the famed Arnaud's Restaurant. And we're talking during the break there. It's always interesting to talk with these guys, and we can just maybe touch on this, Chris, a little bit. For those who don't know, the French 75 cocktail, the namesake of the bar, was originally made with cognac, right? And then became more commonly made with gin.
Yeah.
But and how did that just generally go down?
Well, the first bartenders to put it in a book were, they were British. They worked in Paris, which is, you know, interesting. But they put it in Harry's ABCs. And it's the first time the French 75 is seen, you know, in print. So when anybody wants to go, like, research it, the first time they're going to find it in a cocktail book is with gin. So pretty much most of the world believes it was gin and makes it with gin, which is perfectly fine. But we, at my bar, chose to make it the way the Count preferred his champagne cocktail, which was with cognac. Now, I'm pretty sure Mr. Gustings has something fun about a publication saying where they could get a nice gin, French 75.
I prefer mine with gin, but I also think that if you want it made with tequila, you should make it with tequila. Of course, it's not a French 75 anymore.
Right, that was a deft answer. Right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But it's kind of like, you know, this back and forth about where was it started, how was it started, whatever. You know, if I have a French 75 at the French 75, I will have it the way Chris makes it, which is with cognac.
Right.
Done. And it's a great drink. It really is. It's a really it's a great drink. Yeah. I mean, it, you know.
Well, the book that we were discussing during the break is actually a fantastic cocktail book. And what he was having a little bit of fun with is where the French
say the name of the book, Chris.
Oh, okay. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Bottoms Up by Ted Saucier. And you can still buy them. It's going to be about $80 to $100, but totally worth it, especially if it still comes with a plastic cover. They're really nicely kept. I've seen two. But anyway, as Paul suggested, like I wish he wouldn't have, is Arnaud's specifically submits their recipe in this book as it's the French 75, and it's with gin. It's not the French 75 bar. It's Arnaud's restaurant. And also, like I wanted to point out, it was during Germaine Wells, her reign at the restaurant, which was in the book is published 51. So Count Arnaud has passed away. I know Count Arnaud used cognac because he made his own take on the French 75, which is the Ambrosia, which also has a properly aged spirit in the cocktail.
And what is that, Chris, just so people know?
There's apple brandy. There's apricot brandy, and there's triple sec, a little lemon, and then champagne.
Okay.
Which is really close to a French 75. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so
really,
know, I think made you know, in the right, in a proper way, it would be really close to a French 75.
Got it.
Yeah, but the book again in this era, like I was, I believe, many people believe, you know, that after World War II. Palates, you know, kind of lightened, and that's when like people like light cigarettes and light beers became popular across the country. And so, you know, in Germaine Wells's time here, it's like when vodka and gin started popping up. And I don't think she had too much of a defined palate.
She drank a lot of champagne.
Yeah.
Like a lot of champagne.
A lot of champagne.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Right. She loved champagne.
But I can see her being persuaded with gin like the rest of the country.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and I think it, a couple things. I think it raises the question to a degree, too. You know, we have to look at what was available at the time. And after World War II, things were less commonly available in general. And
well, it's the same thing. You're drinking an old-fashioned. That doesn't mean now it's a very specific drink. At one time, it was a bunch of ingredients. And if you didn't have one of them, then you use the others.
Right.
Just make sure you had booze.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily bourbon. It could be whatever you had. Mm-hmm. If you had rum, you used rum. If you had whatever, you used whatever. You made Applejack in the backyard, that's what you used.
Yeah, and gin's cheaper than cognac.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, you guys. When you talk about even flipping through some of those older cocktail volumes from the 20th century, for example, drink after drink after drink is a slight variation on a theme. Right. Changing one ingredient or two ingredients or something.
Well, that's just still... A lot of people that still do that these days, and they come up with this great new drink, and it's like they make an old fashioned and they add, I don't know, orgeat syrup to it.
Right.
And all of a sudden it's just a great new drink. Like, no, it's not.
Right. You swapped in the mezcal.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just like, it's just, you know, you copied something and now you're making it your own, which is fine. You go ahead.
Right. Well, you know? Paul, you bring up something else too when you say that about, you know, your preference is gin, but when Chris makes it at 75, he makes it with cognac, and
exactly.
That's how you go about it. You raise an interesting question too. I think, you know, people should have what they want when they want, how they like it.
But that depends.
Well, within
reason, okay. Absolutely.
And then, but the other part too is that I think moods change. I get asked this question often. You know, what's your favorite wine? Coming from the wine game, well, I can't really answer that question because, you know, it depends on what I'm eating, depends on time of day, depends on what I had yesterday. And, you know,
it's usually the guys in front of you, right?
The guys in front of you. Exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
If it's free, that's my favorite
exactly.
one.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so Well, let's talk about, okay, we'll actually get to the topic we were going to talk about. Let's talk about winter drinks.
Oh,
yeah,
winter drinks.
That topic, yeah. Winter drinks a little bit here. Yeah. And we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, Paul, and we didn't get to this last time. We were talking about the Tom and Jerry. And Chris, you make a good one.
No, not true. He makes the best one.
He makes the best one.
He makes
okay,
the
even
best
better.
One.
There's
yes.
a superlative.
Yes. It's a great drink.
Yeah, it's well, I'm really glad. I'm really glad that people like it, because it was, in the beginning, it was a lot of fun to make, and I didn't know how well it would take off. But I'm glad there's several people who stop in from Thanksgiving to Mardi Gras, and you know, just to signify the season's change and you know, celebrate. So in the beginning, I didn't think separating these eggs and beating them, you know, with sugar and then pouring it over hot water and whiskey or cognac. I don't know if people would like it, but yeah, it turns
people
out
like that.
People like it.
I don't
yeah.
understand how people think that people would like it, but okay.
Well, I mean, if you make something of an old recipe and you've never made it before, you go,
yeah.
You know?
Well, Chris, tell people. Can you tell people what a Tom and Jerry is if they don't know? Because I think a lot of people maybe don't even know what the drink is actually.
Oh yeah, sure. It's a hot cocktail. For the winter time, and you have a Tom and Jerry batter that you prepare beforehand, which is separating eggs, beating them, both the whites and the yolks, with sugar, putting it back together, a little cream, vanilla, nutmeg, and then storing that in the fridge so it's cool, and then you're ladling it over hot water that's been spiked with a little dark rum and either whiskey or brandy.
Okay. What's your preference there? On the whiskey or the brandy? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't. I think I like the whiskey.
Okay,
but like using Meyer's Dark Rum, it's really good. You know, flavorful. Yeah. And then like you know, I think bourbon, having a couple more ages in wood than cognac, it's a little more. It's a nice mouthfeel.
A little more robust.
It's a great drink. I make mine slightly different, of course.
Okay, go there, Paul.
I put the rum in the batter.
Okay. Oh, nice.
And then let that...
That's
do you cool it down?
Everything else, yes.
Overnight?
Cool, and everything else is exactly the same that way Chris makes it.
Okay. And do you guys let it cool? Does it have to cool and come together overnight?
No.
No,
you
just like... Just
a couple
that
hours,
day.
3 hours.
Well,
yeah.
the
okay.
problem with it is, too, is that if you let it sit too long, the sugar goes to the bottom.
Yeah.
It separates.
And it separates.
Okay.
And if you have wet sugar that you need to reincorporate in whatever else, again, it doesn't really work.
Gotcha.
You know, it's not, you can't keep it for 3 or 4 or 5 days.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah,
first,
usually like the next day, it's
yeah, exactly.
the yolks are on the bottom, yeah. and then it's just, you might as well use that to actually dip bread in and cook like
exactly.
French toast.
There you go,
exactly.
French toast.
Without the syrup.
Yeah, the first time I made it, I followed a recipe that I found somewhere, and it turned out that on a dozen eggs, this person used 5 pounds of sugar.
Oh my goodness.
It's crazy.
And what? I did, and yeah. I tasted it, and I threw it in the garbage can.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, guys, Paul, hold that thought real quick. Let's take a break, because I want 5 pounds of sugar.
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. It's making my heart hurt just thinking about
yeah,
that, friends.
That was...
We're chatting with Paul Gustings and Chris Hanna, and we're here at Two Jags Restaurant in the French Quarter. Friends, come on back.
You used to be my honey, till you spent all my money. For you to cry, I see you by and by, 'cause I'm walking to New Orleans.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from: Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, you know, we are here at Two Jags Restaurant, the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans here in the French Quarter. And Paul Gustings of Two Jags is here with me, as well as Chris Hanna of the French 75 Bar, part of Arno's Restaurant. And you guys, during the break, we were talking about a little bit about cocktails. And what we kind of got onto were a couple books that were out there about three ingredient cocktails. I think that's an interesting topic, because what we were also talking about is these days, it seems, as you said, Paul, people seem to have this need to put 15 different things in a drink, and there's a practicality to...
Or not 15 different things, but like six obscure ingredients that you can only get on March 13th from 9 to 11 or something. I don't know. Right, that you don't ever get anywhere, ever.
Well, you know, it's that bar spoon of that druidic liqueur from ancient Ireland really shines through in the drink.
Yeah. And, you know, and that is, and if you have seasonal drinks, that's okay. Because you can say, hey, look, I can only make this from, I don't know, January to February. That's fine. But even then, you should not go like way overboard on a lot of things, you know. Right. Having said that, I on occasion have been told that I make stuff that nobody's ever heard of.
Okay.
Which is true. I'm just now finishing up on making English milk punch, which people go, huh? But it's a recipe from the 1800s.
All right, so let's talk about that, because people probably know, at least around here, know brandy milk punch.
Oh, this is totally different.
Totally different.
Yeah, this is a clarified milk punch.
Okay.
It's looks like water.
Right.
And it has all kinds of stuff in it. It's not that hard to make, but it's time consuming.
Now, when you do something, and let's talk about that, Paul, a little bit about what the drink is. But sort of what I was getting at with the three cocktail thing is when you're behind the bar and you've got people waiting for a drink, you want to get people their drink, they want their drink, right? Something like that you're talking about, though, I'm assuming that's all pre-prepped. The drink will do all this in advance,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. That's what we talked about the last time, was expediency of making drinks like Sazeracs and stuff like that.
Right, right.
There is all high-volume cocktail bars batch stuff. Because if somebody comes in, if 500 people a night come in and want a Sazerac, it would be a really smart idea to batch it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to finish it all the way, but get like three or four of the ingredients together, or all the ingredients together, so all you need to do is pour it in a glass.
And especially the stuff that's not going to go bad or go south because it's been
pre-made,
right?
Yeah, and I just make Sazeracs because I batch it on occasion. We had a big party the other day, and they wanted all Sazeracs, so I batched like 2 gallons.
Right. Well, and you guys here at Two Jags are a main stop on the cocktail tours.
Correct.
And so there are a handful of drinks that they always come in here and get. The
absolutely.
Grasshopper being one, right?
Grasshopper is batched. Pimscop is batched. Hurricane is batched. There's a few other drinks that are a little more esoteric. Well, they're batched.
Let me ask you guys this question. I'll flip to you, Chris, then you, Paul. When you batch, because I think sometimes maybe people think, oh, batching, that seems kind of lazy. But there can be advantage, aside from the service component, right?
Mm-hmm.
Advantages to batching. I think it maybe possibly allows you, I know with your Pimm's cup, I think maybe the flavors come together a little bit more, and you could do some things that are different if you batch, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably it is to like have less pickups, you know? So like we have a cocktail that has like two different rums. We just, to make it easier, mm-hmm. just put both rums in the same bottle, have two, and just have a backup.
Right.
Because, you know, we're doing like the young rums. There's Agricole and one. I mean, Agricole and Cachaça. So instead of picking up mm-hmm. each one, I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, the initial complaint was how long it took to get a craft cocktail anyway when the whole scene started. It's like,
right.
We just wanted to complain about something. So it's like, I mean, you know, nobody wants to wait. You know what I mean? So, and you just you put together what you think is wisest and what's not going to ruin the drink from what you made it originally. So, like in the pineapple cider, you can add the the pomegranate honey and like shake it and have it just like, you know, pretty much almost like a cordial, like waiting to go against the citrus. And you want, I mean, because you want that fresh, that's separate. So there's only three things you're picking up, which makes it almost a three ingredient drink, pretty much.
Right. There you go.
Yes. Okay. That's very true. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can't batch anything that has citrus in it.
You cannot.
Well,
you can kind of, but
you have to be very, very careful because the stuff goes bad.
You got to keep integrity, so there's no sense. You don't have to do that. Cocktail bars like where we work, you don't need to do that.
No, you don't.
You can speed up the other stuff and have the other stuff ready.
Like the two rums together and a fucare, put the liquor together, whatever. You can do all of those things. And that really, and it's an economy of movement, so you spend less time, and if you can save 30 seconds off of each drink that you make, and you make I don't know how many hundreds of drinks, then you save yourself a whole lot of time.
That compounds over time.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And the overall experience for everyone is affected by this.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Well, Paul, tell us a little bit about the English Milk Punch that you're doing.
English Milk Punch is rum, brandy, arak, cloves, cinnamon, green tea, pineapple, coriander, lemon juice, and then hot milk.
Okay. Clarified.
No.
No.
The hot milk and the lemon juice curdle.
Ah, yes.
So you take the curds out, and the product that's left behind is the English Milk Punch.
Got it. So how much of that can you actually do in advance? So
somebody orders that. I do 5 gallons.
And it's the whole thing. Yep. Whole thing's done.
Yep.
Ready to rock.
Yep.
Got it.
Okay. I refrigerate it and it stays good forever.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
The reason I know
you have that
is,
now?
What's that?
I'm
making it right now.
Oh, okay.
The reason I know that because
that's what I was thinking, Chris.
Yeah, the reason I know that is because I found a bottle, because I date everything, put the name on it, date it, I found a bottle that was like 6 months old. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh God. And I tasted it and it was just fine.
Interesting. So what when you came up with that drink, I'm assuming that it's based on something, but like arak's an interesting choice.
I didn't come up with that drink. That's an old drink from the 1800s.
With arak?
With arak, yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, arak was a very common ingredient in how many things? Everything?
Yeah, it makes you wonder about real Swedish punch. But no, that's really
I have some downstairs. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I was wondering about the green tea and the rock were really kind of, I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's why I was wondering when you were having it ready.
Next week.
Okay.
We'll be here, man. I'll meet you here, Chris. We'll check that out.
Right on.
Cool. Yeah, so that, as you make in your batching, so does it need to kind of sit and come together or something like that? Or is it just the time? Okay.
Yes. I let it sit for a while, depending on a bunch of circumstances. Like if... Sometimes I forget, and it's 9 days. Sometimes I think about it, and it's 7 days, you know? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make that much of a difference. There are a couple of exceptions. Like, you cannot have a Swedish punch, like you mentioned, that has to be 6 to 7 days. After 7 days, it's not drinkable. Because the lemon goes into the arak and the rum so much that it's just terrible.
Does it just become a sort of a stale citric bitter taste? Is that what we're talking about? Okay, got it. So you're also doing a hot buttered rum?
Yes.
Currently. That is currently available.
That is currently available right downstairs as of right now, as of like a month ago, actually.
And we'll tell people what that is in case they don't know.
Okay. Of course, again, I do everything slightly different. It usually... most places where you go, you get a hot buttered rum, you get a shot of rum, hot water, and butter that has spices in it, which basically I don't like because you're still drinking hot water. So what I do is I infuse water with dark brown sugar, cinnamon sticks, and cloves, and reduce that liquid by half, and to that I add rum and butter.
Do you infuse that for a period of time?
No, I just boil it.
Just boil it. And just
yeah,
do
boil it,
it
and let
stove.
It. Yeah, Got boil it and okay. reduce it by half.
Okay.
So if I do 2 gallons of water, by the time it gets to 1 gallon of water, it's done, and it's ready for consumption.
Got it. That's pretty cool.
It's a little extra work, but the end result is worth it. It's really good.
Okay. And I mean, and again, something that you can do in advance. So you're not setting yourself up for that. Well, you guys, let's do this. We're going to do one more segment with y'all. We're going to take a quick break here on the show. We're going to come back and wrap things up with Chris and Paul. Come on back.
This is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Goodbye, Joe. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are here at Two Jags Restaurant here in the French Quarter, right on Decatur, the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans. And we are chatting with Chris Hanna of the French 75 Bar, as well as Paul Gustings here of Two Jags. Paul, thanks again for having us here today.
No, thank you very much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. It's good to see you both. Really, really fun to have you guys on again. We did a show with you guys about a month ago, and it's always fun just to... And I always like this because we talk about, okay, here's what we're going to talk about. And we kind of actually got a little bit more of what we're going to talk about, but I always know with you two that it's just going to kind of work out. Nobody has a piece of paper in front of them. There were no bullets, Paul, that we were talking about.
Oh, no?
No, okay. No, there were okay. None. All right, there's nothing in my outbox that didn't go or that you didn't receive. But so we actually did get a little bit to winter and seasonal drinks. And Chris, we were talking a little bit at the break over there at 75 that you've got, other than the Tom and Jerry, what you're doing right now, you've got some other stuff going on.
Yeah, well, we have a hot buttered rum as well. not going to discuss my hot butter batter with Mr. Gustings. But yeah, you know, like you know, at my bar, we have to, like I was saying, we got to keep up with the kids and have more than just a couple things available, which is, you know, it's fun. It's, you know, it can be time consuming. But anyway, you know, we're doing the Oaxacan Oaxacan hot chocolate, which, you know, it's actually really good. You know, a mix of tequila and mezcal based hot water and you know, really good hot chocolate. It's actually really, really tasty and perfect when the weather is right. And we also have one of my friends makes smoked apple butter, and that's a really, really really cool. It makes a really nice scotch hot cocktail.
Wait, you make smoked apple butter?
Yeah, I mean, actually we have regular apple butter. We even have pumpkin butter.
Where do you get apple butter?
I had to order it. She mailed it to me.
I was going to say, because I've been looking for apple butter for years.
Yeah, we have. It's really good. I mean, you pretty much treat it like hot buttered rum, you know?
The stuff that looks like molasses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really, really good with piping hot water and, you know, either rum or scotch in that, and then cinnamon stick to stir. It's a really good hot toddy. And then we even have like a cold pineapple cider cocktail. So, you know, we're doing our cold drinks are, you know, we have fun seasonal spice. It's a good time of the year. You're walking around, everything's decorated, you know, it tickles your palate with all the different spices. And when it's cold, it makes you happier, but, you know.
Well, we are here in New Orleans, Chris. So, Tuesday here that we're taping this, and it's about 70 degrees outside.
I'm the only moron wearing a long sleeve. I don't care.
I wear my leather jacket anyway.
you look good when I walked in, Paul. Yeah. You did look good, man. And you're fashionista. Yeah.
Very true.
So, Paul, what anything else seasonal that you got going on that you've been talking about?
No, not really. We just do the hot butter rum Irish coffee, the regular stuff, nothing specific.
Okay.
But I like the apple butter, because I've been trying to get apple butter basically for years.
Okay.
And I have not been able to find anywhere, because I'm really like not very good at going online and looking for stuff. You know? Did I put that in a decent way there? That I don't look too stupid. Because that is an ingredient you can use in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
it's really versatile.
Yeah,
it's really, really good.
What would some examples be of other things, like just in general?
Well, I was going to find it because there's a dish that asks for it that's cooking. It's beef that you overnight with onions and vinegar. And then you put the apple butter in it, and you let it soak for a little while, and then you cook it. You broil it really slow. Braise it, whatever it's called, over like a 4 or 5 hour time. That's why I wanted the apple butter to begin with. And then I make molasses drinks downstairs. And
I think swapping that out
would be a really good idea. But like I said, I don't know where to get the stuff.
Paul, what's going to happen is if you Google apple butter, then anytime you go to any other website, there'll be all kinds of plug-in ads and say, apple butter, buy here, apple butter, buy here. Trust me.
You know,
you can find it anywhere.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
And he's right.
So can I borrow your computer, because I don't have one?
Okay, yeah. Fair.
I was thinking about sending him a can.
Yeah, and if he was going to tell me that he's set his security settings so high that he can't be tracked online after what you just said, I'm going to say BS. There's no way.
Security what?
Uh-huh. Yeah. What were you going to say, Chris? Sorry.
Oh, no. I was just saying he's right. You can, the versatility of it, you know, stir it. You can, you know, definitely stir it with an old fashioned. Mm-hmm. Shake it. You can shake it in a scotch sour. Mm-hmm. You know,
absolutely.
Okay. Double strain. Yeah. I mean, the flavor of good apple butter is really delicious.
It is amazing. It really is.
So, yeah. Now, Chris, if you were to say, just let's take the old fashioned as an example. If you were to stir it into an old fashioned, really how much would you want to put in? Just a spoonful kind of thing, or
yeah, definitely half ounce at the most.
Okay,
you know, yeah. it's not necessarily too sweet. It's just really good flavor.
Would you use that in lieu of simple?
Or
in combination?
Yeah,
and
then no more.
No, okay.
What you could do is you make yourself a nice. You could just blend it with maple syrup, and then use that as your syrup. Because right now we're doing a maple syrup old fashioned.
Okay,
just for the season. Mm-hmm. Or like a good heavy demerara, and then mix the whole thing, strain it, you know, because that cooked apple flavor in the butter.
The taste stays.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And then shaking it with a traditional scotch sour, you know. You can do bourbon. It's just a lot more. It's just fun because of the smoke, you know. Any kind of sour, like you were saying, like throw a whole spoonful, heaping spoonful, shake it, double strain it. It's pretty nice.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
And so it's gonna, I'm gonna guess, add a little bit of mouthfeel too, right? To give a little bit of viscosity and all that.
Yeah, because apple butter is it's basically looks and pours like molasses.
Okay.
It's really that. Can you even pour it? I think you have to spoon it. Right?
You have to spoon it.
Yeah, you have to spoon it. You can't even pour it. Okay. I mean, you can, but it's going to take forever.
Do you guys,
it's slower than molasses.
It's slower than molasses, right? I've been told that before about me. Do you guys use, since we're here in the South, and you know, we can get certain things in the South, Paul, we were talking about during the break, how Southerners here, we Southerners don't get Southern things. So yeah. We do not have whatever you said. But anyway, what about Steen's cane syrup? Do you guys use that in anything?
I don't use cane syrup in anything.
Okay.
You gotta, you have to break it down. It's pretty heavy.
Yeah, that's heavy stuff.
Yeah, that flavor is pretty intense.
That's a lot.
Okay, yeah.
People do. No, I mean, yeah. I know that bars do, because I mean, it's a local ingredient, and everybody wants to, you know, give it a shot. So I mean, I'm positive if you walk around, there's gonna be somebody doing a Steen's cane syrup old fashioned somewhere.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. I had an acquaintance of mine was down from the Northeast and had never tasted Steen, so. Got them a taste of Steen's, just, you know, spoonful while we were eating out at a restaurant, and they wanted a case. I said, okay, I said you can get it online. But yeah. you can't get that online too, Paul, by the way, that Steen's.
From the same Google that I can
from
do.
From the same Google
that I can do.
Somebody said to me the other day, the internet is a store, and it's open 24 hours. And I said, where is the store? And they said, on my phone. Yeah. Well, you guys, we got about a minute and a half left, so I appreciate you being here. Chris, why don't you tell people where they can come see you at the French 75 Bar in Arnos?
French 75 Bar is on Bienville between Bourbon and Dauphine, 813 Bienville. It's next inside Arnold's restaurant, Tuesday through Saturday.
Excellent. And Paul?
Decatur Street is at Two Jacks. No, Two Jacks is on Decatur Street. 823 Decatur Street, half a block off of Jackson Square. I'm off on Tuesdays and Fridays. I'm here every other day after 3 o'clock usually.
Yep. So you're generally here in the evenings, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yep. Excellent. You guys, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate the
hospitality.
You're
more than welcome.
Paul.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
We'll do it again at the very least. We'll come back in and we'll plan to talk about maybe carnival cocktails or something like that. How does that sound?
That sounds pretty excellent.
Yeah, we got some time until, I think, Carnival's slightly later than it was last year, right?
This time around. It's the day before Valentine's Day.
Oh, it's the 13th. I was thinking it was later. Okay. No. Well, that'll work. It's a week later or so. Yeah. Last
Next
four month. Days.
Well, actually, I think for Mardi Gras, we should have all our drinks done in a grocery cart.
I think that sounds like a great idea. And I think I may be seeing you on Monday, Chris, but that's a secret thing for another time. Friends, thanks so much for tuning in, and we're going to take a little break here. We're going to be back with a little bit more here on the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz with you here, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Actually, we're at Two Jags in the French Quarter. Come check them out. Come on back.
Don't get no more salty than Barataria Bay. 100 years my family's done it this way. Some folks call it work, but it's just another day. And in life there's always love. Comes into your heart from up above.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu.
Life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Everybody, welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed that interview there with Chris and Paul. I always find it fascinating to talk to those two guys. As I said at the beginning of the show, they are just a wealth of information and knowledge. And I can tell you that the conversations that you can imagine that we have actually when we take breaks, and obviously we recorded that on Tuesday a couple days ago, if you're listening here on the radio, is you know, it doesn't go the length of the commercials. Oftentimes these are 15 or 20 minute conversations in between, and those are also really fascinating, sometimes off the record, so I can't share certain things with you, but and sometimes they just sort of bleed from the interview right into something we talk about, and then that informs the next segment. But these guys are great to talk to, and it's always interesting, as I was telling my wife the other day, to listen to these guys talk, and kind of, they're good friends, but you put them in this environment where we're talking about, say, some specifics of a cocktail or a particular spirit, and one of them will say something, I will go, I didn't know that, or how did you find that, or where did you come across that, and it was in this old cocktail book. So watching those guys trade information also is really very fascinating. I learned something, and it's a privilege to be able to do that, especially sitting there at Two Jags, which is a great restaurant there on Decatur. Go check it out, second oldest restaurant in New Orleans. Friends, I did mention that if you're looking for event listings, we didn't usually do our usual rundown of events going on around town other than talking about the Revion dinners. Go check out followyourjoy.com to see those menus and who's participating in the Revion on the Rocks drink stuff, as well as the price fixed meals, what restaurants, prices, menus, so on and so forth. But go check out Frank Stansberry's wonderful daily newsletter that comes out. I believe it comes out Monday through Friday. It's called La Fete, L-A, of course, new word, F-E-T-E, news. You can find him on Facebook. You can sign up for his e-newsletter through Facebook. Just go check that out, because he runs down stuff every single day that you can do in the greater New Orleans area. And as we know here in town, there is a lot. Wanted to get to a story that came out a little while ago, actually a little bit over a week ago, week and a half ago, in Fortune magazine. Hadn't had a chance to talk about it yet. There was a London-based writer. The guy's name is Ubah Butler, and I love that first name, Ubah. That would be something like when he was a kid. If you're the dad, you probably want to go Ubah and yell at him to get into the house and stop playing and come eat dinner and wash behind your ears. But Vice, so he writes for Vice, which you probably have heard of. And his name is Ubah Butler, and he recently impersonated a fashion designer for a Paris for the Paris Fashion Week, which was a while back. And he creates these ruses, I guess, to do things. And what he did in this particular situation is he created a fake restaurant to fool TripAdvisor. Now, I'm not picking on TripAdvisor. That's actually how my wife and I found our wonderful spot where we stayed in an apartment on the beach over in the Florida Panhandle, and it worked out great. But I think it's kind of to show the pitfalls of some of these sites like TripAdvisor and Yelp. And I guess I'm just going to, here's my one take-home message, and I'll tell you the story, is that, you know, always use these things, and they're good pieces of information, but don't take them as the gospel, okay? Use it to synthesize larger pieces of information, you know, using that as just one piece of the puzzle to make your judgment if you're going to go somewhere. Then go out and experience the place for yourself, and, you know, then think about what you do. Don't do the hot top 10 list stuff, okay? Use that information, but keep in mind of what it really represents and how good that information really is. So there's my little thing. But he created this restaurant called The Shed at Dulwich. It's not really a restaurant, of course, which was basically his backyard cottage that he calls home. And he set up this restaurant. He used a cheap disposable phone to have a phone number, did not provide an address, because he was saying this was a, you know, appointment only or reservation only. So that kind of, you know, you had to basically, you know, make this reservation, then be told where the restaurant was. That was the idea. He faked photos of the food. He used shaving cream, believe believe it or not, bleach tablets in his own feet to create mock-ups of these dishes. He got friends and allies to write glowing fake reviews, and they were all unique and came from different computers, so that basically didn't trip TripAdvisor's fraud detection stuff. It's not coming from the same IP address. And then things, as he said, got out of hand very quickly. From the, as he says, from the very bottom of the TripAdvisor's charts, he indicates that his fake restaurant steadily climbed the London ranking. So this was right outside of London or in London. He started getting emails and phone calls asking for reservations. And then the interest kept going up and up and up. And he kept just telling people, sorry, we're fully booked for the next 6 weeks. So people start trying to make these reservations. And then it was strange, too, in that food suppliers started guessing the shed's address and somehow, I don't know how, and they started sending him free samples of food material stuff. And then job applications started rolling in. PR companies even contacted him to offer their services. And the dude had never even, you know, served a meal. And then it continued to climb the rankings, and it became one of the top-rated restaurants in London, believe it or not. And again, the dude had never served a meal, okay? And this was it was actually in the top for 2 whole weeks. And so what he did is he took his stunt to a conclusion here, cleaned up his yard, had some guests over, and he served them frozen dinner straight from the grocery store. And some of the guests apparently saw through the ruse, thought it was kind of funny, but then some were so enthusiastic about the concept that they bought in what seems to be this sort of unique, kitschy, I guess, maybe experience, and immediately requested a rebooking. Okay, they were eating TV dinners. All right, friends, they were eating TV dinners. And then, well, the TripAdvisor has come back and said it doesn't prove much since there's a real-world incentive for anyone to create a fake restaurant. But as the article here in Fortune points out, that misses the larger point. We rely, and this was my point at the beginning to a degree, we rely more and more on the internet for information. A lot of that information can't be trusted. You have to remember that. We talk about this, and I talk about this with wine reviews, okay? For example, I think that story's hilarious, by the way, just so you know. But we talk about, say, wine reviews, and I get a lot of people that knock wine bloggers because they're not professionals. If we go back to some wine reviews and the concept of, we'll pick on Robert Parker here a little bit from Wine Spectator. A lot of people took Robert Parker as the gospel. One of the things that I know, we were talking about how I teach wine classes, everybody tastes differently. And one of the things that I share in a wine class is 4 different reviews, 3 publications and a winemaker of the tasting notes, okay? The aromas, the flavor, so on and so forth. And I share that. And there's some relation that you can find, like one guy says coffee and one guy says toffee and one guy says chocolate mocha or something like that. So you can understand that some of those flavor notes are coming from the same family or group, but they're 4 distinctly different descriptions, and these are from professionals, including a winemaker, in this case, the winemaker of the wine in question, and it was a 1992 Pride Mountain there in Napa Merlot. Okay, so my point is here is that, you know, everybody tastes differently. We'll talk about that some other time, how that works through both experience and biological hardwiring, if you will, but people pick on bloggers a lot when it comes to, you know, reviewing wines, and lots of times these people are amateurs to a degree, sure, but maybe they have some valuable information. Maybe you like their palate. A lot of people, as I said, took Robert Parker's word for the gospel. Robert Parker liked really big wines. A lot of people don't like really big wines. So if everything that you know, if you liked Robert Parker's palate and you trusted him, that's great. And then maybe you don't need any other source of information. But if you sort of take one source as the gospel, TripAdvisor, Yelp, a wine blogger, Robert Parker, whatever we're talking about, I think you're kind of missing the ability to go out and take advantage of some of the things that are out there. Yes, the amount of information on the internet and publications can be overwhelming, friends, these days. But you can kind of use these things. I like to multi-reference, I guess I'll use that term, to look at a restaurant. Yeah, I'll go look at Yelp and see what people had to say and kind of take it for what it is and realize that if we're talking, say, about a particular ethnic cuisine that's not usually well represented in an area, and I look at who the people are, if they said, hey, I lived in that country for 5 years, I know what that food's supposed to taste like, bing, I'm going to pay attention a little bit, okay? But, you know, just kind of look at these different things and then make a decision on what you want to go try. And then, of course, what is ultimately important is what it is that you like. So there is no substitute for going out and experiencing a restaurant, a bottle of wine, or anything else, a band, who knows, unless you go hear it for yourself, friends. So use this information to make an informed decision, or maybe a guesstimate, if you will, of what you think you might like or want to go do or taste or whatever. But don't take all this stuff as the gospel, and don't necessarily get mad at the source. You know, I don't like listicles and top 10 stuff because I think they're flawed in how they go about things, and we've talked a lot about that on the show. But hey, if you want to reference something, maybe it informs you of a new restaurant that's out there, and then go look at Yelp and go look at the newspaper, what their review was, and ask a friend who's been there and put all that in a basket and say, man, I think I'm going to go give it a try. Or say, man, I don't think I'm going to give it a try. try. Let me try something else. So there you go. That's kind of how I think you need to sort of approach these things and always be, you know, be a little bit skeptical about what you're reading there online, especially on some of these review sites. Friends, I hope everyone again has a great holiday season. I really appreciate you listening here to the Nola Drinks Show. As always, whether you're listening here on the radio on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, or you're listening, in podcast land, wherever you may be, as we like to say, I hope everyone has a safe and wonderful Christmas. If you're celebrating Christmas, whatever you're celebrating with loved ones here in the holiday season, I hope everyone has a really good one and has a joyous time. We will be back with a new show next week. We're going to be joined by Dr. Michael Nisley of Bubbliotech. What are we going to be talking about? Champagne and New Year's, of course. So thanks for tuning in, friends. Happy holidays. Be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.